Welcome along to this latest Fraser Vallander podcast. This week it's Gerrard's week, and what we thought we would do is take this opportunity to talk a bit about the background of Gerrard, how it's produced, and try to dispel some of the myths that surround the publication. So for that, I'm joined by Mary Spowage, Deputy Director in the Institute, and must confess, and full disclosure in all of this, both Mary and I worked on Gerrard when we were civil servants a number of years ago. So we know a bit about the background of it, how it's produced, and how it's pulled together, how it's presented, and also some of the issues around interpretation and the caveats and the level of caution you should use when interpreting it. So to kick us off, Mary, what is GERS?
So GERS is essentially trying to produce an estimated set of public sector accounts for Scotland. So broadly, it's trying to estimate how much is spent for the good of people of Scotland and how much is raised in tax and other revenues from Scotland. So this might sound, you know, fairly straightforward and controversial, but as we start to get into it, as we hopefully will in this podcast, it does get into some of the heart of the constitutional debate that goes on in Scotland. And for some reason, you know, people on both sides of that debate seem to sort of lose all sense of balance when they try to interpret the GERS figures. What we have to remember is that GERS takes the current constitutional settlement is given. So it's where we are now. It's backward looking. So the figures that come out this week will be in reference to the financial year 2019-20. So for example, it allocates Scotland a per capita share of the spending at the UK level on defence, on the assumption that everyone in Scotland benefits, if you like, from the provision of that defence. Importantly, it's a statistical publication and it doesn't make a judgment on whether it's the right amount of money that's spent on defence or debt interest or other things. And it certainly doesn't tell us what a more fiscally autonomous Scotland or an independent Scotland might do. So that's the really first important thing to remember, is that it takes the current constitutional settlement as given. But GERS has been around for quite a long time, and sometimes the origins of the publication cause people to kind of question its viability, I suppose.
Yeah, that's right. So looking back at economic history in Scotland, you see that GERS was started in the early 90s, and a lot of the commentary that's happened since then, from a political perspective, have been about how GERS was created by what were then Conservative government running the Scotland office, and essentially creating the document as a way that they were looking to help, in their view, inform the debate in devolution. But of course, like any kind of government document that's trying to push forward a narrative, very much putting forward the case that Scotland was essentially benefiting greatly from being part of the UK and having higher public expenditure relative to its revenues. Now, and back then, GERS was very much a kind of ministerial document, if you can call it that, in that sense. So it was trying to present analysis in a way which was, in their view, factual and analytical, but very much about trying to trying to push the narrative of the government at the time. And we see that, you know, even in today, you know, governments will push forward and prepare analytical documents or policy documents that are informed by evidence, but it's very much pushing forward or an interpretation of the facts in a government, from the government of the day and their political viewpoint. So that was very much the genesis of GERS, and that's probably hung around GERS and had cast a shadow over how GERS has been interpreted over the years, because it had that kind of background where it was seen as being largely a political document designed to push forward a particular political agenda at the time. And I guess one of the kind of key implications for that is that now then creates, even though it's a statistical publication nowadays, it then creates this much broader debate about how the figures should be interpreted and that underlying political narrative. But it is an official statistical publication now, and it therefore carries certain kite marks and guidance. And Mary, maybe you could just talk us through what it means to be an official and of course a national statistics publication.
Yeah, so as you say, GERS is an accredited national statistics publication, and it has been for many years, and it has been assessed continuously by the body who's responsible for awarding that, the UK Statistics Authority, every few years since then, since it's been awarded at first in the mid-2000s. So what it means to be an official or national statistics publication is that it's produced independently of ministers, so free from political interference, and that it uses the best methods that are possible. So it uses sound methods, which have been subject to significant consultation with users of the publication. And also that it's of high public value. So it's a product that's worth producing because it informs the policy and political debate in Scotland. This is one of the important things to remember with GERS is that it's a national statistics publication, but it is produced by the Scottish Government. So as Graham said, both him and I worked on GERS at various times during our career when we worked in the Scottish Government. We've never worked for UK government departments. And in producing this document, there was never any conversations with, for example, the Treasury about what would go in it. These statistics were produced solely by the Scottish Government. And that's one of the myths that sort of gets perpetrated about GERS, that it's somehow produced by Westminster. But it is worth saying that GERS has been on quite an evolution since it started, as Graham said. Now it is a proper official statistics publication and goes under a lot of scrutiny about its methods, and it has improved a lot over the years. Back in the day, in the 2000s, our friends Jim and Margaret Cuthbert did a lot of work, for example, on the methods in GERS, and there was even a parliamentary inquiry about the methods that were used. So since then, it's undergone a large review, including involving the UK Statistics Authority, to ensure that the methods are very sound. And as a government statistician, I've never known a product to be more scrutinised, more conversations with users about the methods that are used, and even cross department working on the best way to estimate different things. A huge amount of work and collaboration goes on in order to assure that the methods in GERS are the best they possibly can be. That culminated in the most recent review of GERS, which actually concluded in 2014. And I was the senior statistician when that was done. And there's consultation every year with users about the methods used in GERS. So as I say, you would not see a more scrutinised national statistics publication, which means the methods in it are the best that they possibly can be for producing these estimates.
I didn't actually realise that you did the review in 2014, because I was on my first job when I joined the government in 2007 was to lead the review from the economic side of things. And it was really quite funny. And again, it's just interesting when you look back at the history that surrounds all of GERS. So we did that. We kicked that off in 2007, and the next GERS publication, which was quite radically different in 2008. So it added in North Sea oil on a proper basis. It split up government expenditure and capital and current expenditure, and did lots of other things, improved the methodology a lot. And it actually came back. You mentioned the parliamentary inquiry that kicked off, and I think it was early 2007. It's quite funny reading that back, because Mr. Swinney, John Swinney, was the deputy convener of the committee at the time, and he was giving the government officials at the time a bit of a hard time over some of the analysis that was going into GERS. And then just a few months later, he was then the cabinet secretary for finance, ultimately responsible for GERS. So it was interesting again just to see how the debate on GERS and the narrative of GERS has kind of been really quite controversial over the years. But if you can actually still get the original GERS publications, and you get on the Scottish Government website, and you can see the significant change in quality from a short pamphlet of some quite in some ways ropey assumptions about various numbers flying around from the early kind of the ones produced in the 90s through to something which is, you know, whether you agree or disagree with assumptions is quite clearly now much more sound from a methodology point of view and much more robust from an analytical point of view.
Yeah, and you can see that the methods in JERS and the techniques used by the statisticians to produce the best estimates possible have now been used across the UK. The ONS now produce a publication which is trying to do JERS style estimates for all of the regions of England and the other devolved nations. And it's very much following the same methods as used in JERS, and the Scottish Government statisticians involved were very much leaders in sort of sharing the methods and discussing how they could be improved. So, I mean, it really shows how that they are really the best estimates possible, that essentially the ONS are following the Scottish Government's lead in how you would do this across the UK.
Yeah, and I mean, I guess given that the best estimates possible, that doesn't mean that they are perfect. And we'll come on to how you interpret JERS, and actually the biggest challenge and quite legitimate criticism of JERS is that it's used outside of what it's meant to be designed for. So it gets dragged into big debates about the constitution and the like, when actually what it is doing is providing as robust an estimate as possible for the status quo and how much is spent and raised at the current time. And one of the criticisms that goes into JERS is that word estimation. Mm-hmm. And that somehow, quite bizarrely in some ways in recent years, has come up as being somehow that's a problem with JERS, and JERS can be dismissed because it relies on estimates. So could you maybe just talk us through that and your interpretation of the role of estimates in JERS?
Yeah, sure. It is one of the most bizarre things as a statistician to hear this being a case for dismissing the figures entirely, as if an estimate is the same as a complete guess, which obviously it isn't. But it is important to note initially, when you're looking at both sides of the equation, if you look at the spending side of JERS, the majority of spending isn't estimated. There isn't a methodology that's used to estimate it. It's actual spending figures. The majority of spending is by local government and Scottish Government in Scotland, which makes up well over half the spending that's accounted for in JERS. And then there's another large chunk, which is social security spending by the UK government, which again isn't estimated. There's actual administrative data on how much is spent in Scotland. So you end up with the vast majority of spending actually being accounted for by administrative data, which tells us how much is actually spent in Scotland. And when we're talking about the majority of the remainder of reserve spending, so particularly items that get a lot of debate, like spending on defence and debt interest, the data on overall spending levels is known. Where the estimation comes in is how it's apportioned to Scotland. I mean, we can come back to that. But there isn't a huge amount of the spending data that's actually estimated. It's worth saying that on the revenue side, the situation is different. For some of them, we do know how much is raised in Scotland, particularly since more taxes have been devolved. So things like council tax and business rates and income tax now, land and building transaction tax, we know how much is raised in Scotland. But for the rest, we do have to rely on estimation. So for example, there's a method used to estimate the share of oil revenues that should be apportioned to Scotland each year. Various survey sources are used to estimate the amount of VAT that's raised in Scotland each year. But for some, the fact that we use these techniques to estimate revenues that are raised in Scotland is an excuse to kind of dismiss the figures in JERS sort of out of hand. Now, this isn't really a sensible thing to say for sort of two reasons. Firstly, estimates aren't unusual in economic statistics. We wouldn't be able to estimate anything about the Scottish economy, wouldn't be able to produce any figures like GDP or employment or unemployment statistics if there wasn't a degree of estimation in those. Many of them rely on survey sources, which come with an associated degree of uncertainty. And that's not just for Scotland, it's the same for the UK. There's estimation involved in the production of any economic statistic. So what really matters is whether they're good estimates or not. For example, in GERS, we've got some confidence intervals around what are some of the main tax estimates. And it shows that our confidence in those numbers, there is some variability that could be expected. But the sorts of uncertainty we're talking about is very, very small in the scheme of the overall revenues that are raised in Scotland. So if you do hear people dismissing GERS because it relies on estimation, I guess what I would say is that it's not a valid criticism of the figures. The question to ask is, are they good estimates and are they based on the best methods possible? And I would say that they are, given the scrutiny that these figures receive and haven't been involved in actually producing them.
Great. So, and that's on the revenue side of things. And I mean, the other thing that I would say to people, if they're questioning the estimates, is obviously, well, what alternatives would you come forward with? And if you don't believe that, for example, that Scotland spends approximately a per capita share, or maybe slightly above, on say alcohol duties, well, what different number would you use? And if you think about, you know, the type of economy that we have in Scotland, which is an economy that is performing relatively well in the context of the UK as a whole, then the revenues show that on a revenue and a per head basis, Scotland raises, you know, pretty much bang on a UK average tax take per head. I mean, slightly lower now, but once you include oil, not that far away from the UK average. I mean, you think about the unbalanced nature of the UK economy and London, southeast, but then weaker parts of the UK. Again, that makes sense. So I think one of the other challenges I'd put to people who question these estimates is, well, actually, why are they wrong, and what would your alternatives be? But then also, if you were to change the estimates in any significant way, would they have an impact on the overall narrative? So would they change your conclusion about how much Scotland raises as a country in the current constitutional settlement? And again, you see, as you mentioned, when you play around with confidence intervals or different assumptions about whether we raise more tax in one area or another, they don't really have a meaningful difference to the overall aggregate headline numbers. They will at the margin, of course they will, but they won't necessarily have a big impact for the headline numbers.
Yeah, because what's clear, no matter how you would kind of play around with any of those numbers, is that spending in Scotland is significantly higher than the UK average. As you see on the revenue side, broadly similar to the UK, a wee bit lower in recent years, but it's spending where the big difference really is. And that's not because of changes that have happened in recent years necessarily, but it's more the historic nature of the way the Scottish budget's funded through the Barnett formula, which has kept spending per head in Scotland higher than the UK average over the years.
Yeah, and there's good reasons why that's the case. It costs more to deliver same levels of public services across a more remote country like Scotland. There are certain aspects of the public sector, Scottish Water, that are still part of the public sector. They're not part of the public sector in the UK. We have in some social security benefits, we have a higher caseload, higher take up in Scotland than other parts of the UK, or the UK as a whole, like, you know, many other areas of the UK that have gone through industrial decline. That's relatively higher in Glasgow, for example, so that lifts our spending on a per head basis. So the drivers of higher public expenditure in Scotland, I think, are pretty much uncontroversial. And on the revenue side, it's pretty much the same as very close to being the UK. And that's really the key, messages that GERS, that the GERS analysis pulls out from you. And of course, then again, coming back to the same old caveat, under the current settlement, that's the nature of how it works. If you change Barnet, if you move to different methods of autonomy, then these numbers will change. But at the current framework, that's what the headlines are giving you, higher public expenditure and revenues that reflect basically the Scottish economy as being pretty much on par with the UK as a whole.
Yeah, absolutely. And as you see, the methods that are used to estimate the revenues, you could question them, you could come up with alternatives perhaps, although, as you say, that's up to the people who challenge them to come up with alternatives that might be a better way of estimating certain types of revenues. But any sort of variability in those revenues wouldn't change the overall message, as you say, about the same as the UK on revenues, but much higher spending per head on the spending side.
Yeah, and there's also, again, over the years, you get quite a few different, again, theories about elements of public expenditure that are allocated to Scotland when they shouldn't be. And again, Jez is really upfront about that. In the sense that on things like defence and debt interest, it says, well, this is the allocation based on a population share. You can then change different assumptions around that and you'll get different numbers at the margin. So defence and debt interest come to about 6.5 billion. So if you choose different assumptions than that, you'll get slightly different numbers. But that's 6.5 billion in the context of 75 billion of spend. So it's not going to radically change the overall headline number. But also as well over the years, and again, you mentioned Jim and Margaret Cuthbert, who did some amazing work with getting data out of the Treasury over the years, which is now much more transparent, thankfully. But to try and work out, well, actually, where was money being allocated in the GERS numbers to Scotland when it shouldn't have been? And I think there was a couple when I was doing it, things like museums in different parts of the UK that had somehow been allocated a per capita share to Scotland, and we stopped doing that and changed it so they were no longer being allocated. But then also we did it the other way as well. I think Dounreay was the one that I remember, which for some reason the decommissioning costs were all allocated to Scotland, and it was quite clear that that didn't make sense. It wasn't accurate because the decommissioning was for a nuclear facility that was for the UK as a whole. So we allocated only a per capita share of Dounreay decommissioning rather than the full share, which had been initially in previous years allocated. So, again, you can dispute whether some of the specific assumptions were right, and you can dispute whether or not under different constitutional settlements you would get different numbers. Yep. But the idea that there's rogue billions and billions and billions of pounds being allocated to Scotland and not showing up in the GERS numbers, isn't accurate.
Absolutely. And, the statisticians in the Scottish Government go through the spending items in a lot of detail, particularly where they're allocated to Scotland and they're non-identifiable and trying to figure out if those allocations make sense. The Dounreay one is an obvious example. There's been others over the years on the London Olympics, for example. But these are all very clearly set out in the GERS publication, where the statisticians in the Scottish Government have said, this isn't correct, so we've taken a different view here. But it is worth saying that those are very small in the context, again, of the 75 billion, they're really around the margins, and they wouldn't change the overall message anyway. But it shows the level of detail that the statisticians will go into to ensure that the spending figures are as accurate as they possibly can be.
And there have been some other controversies in recent years around interpretation of some of the numbers. So one of the ones which we found kind of amusing last year, but also in quite a sad way, about the calculation, the relative calculation of Scotland's deficit to the UK. And I think people were talking about Scotland's deficit being Scotland making up 50% of the UK deficit, and that was therefore justification for why these numbers were completely bogus. Completely forgetting that that you've got other parts of the UK as well. Some make a positive contribution, some make a negative contribution, because of the unequal nature of the UK economy. And because you have London in the southeast sucking in so much economic activity, therefore tax revenue necessarily follows that they will be running notional estimated surpluses. So taking the ratio of the Scottish number compared to the UK number is just complete nonsensical.
Yeah, that was quite a funny one, because it was a way you could kind of demonstrate it quite neatly in just a picture and a chart, you know, why obviously it would make sense to take the either surplus or deficit from one part of the UK and compare it to the UK as a whole and say that, you know, how could this possibly be true? Even last year, I remember there was people taking the figures for Wales had just been published. By Cardiff Business School as well, and people were adding Scottish and Welsh numbers together and saying this is bigger than the UK deficit, how can this possibly be true? It's like, well, it can be, because there are other bits of the UK which have a net fiscal surplus. So actually we've just published a page on our website which goes through all of these arguments and has that picture, which is quite helpful if you want to have a look at that. And just shows the sort of relative surplus and deficits of different parts of the UK. But yeah, that was one of the funnier ones. But hopefully we can help in trying to dispel some of these myths as they come up.
But it does get to one of the criticisms of JERS. I think one of the legitimate criticisms of JERS, in that JERS shows cases Scotland versus the UK as a whole.
Yeah.
And we know that the UK is an exceptionally unequal economy. And you then get this impression that Scotland is somehow, you know, wildly out from the rest of the UK, and it's not. The UK, when you start to apportion these deficits and surpluses and you look around, it just is another way of showing how unequal the UK economy is. So you see London and the South East generating significant levels of tax revenue because that's where the city is, that's where high earners are, that's where businesses corporate headquarters, etc., and book their profits. So we know that, and that's shown up in all the data, whether it be GDP data, whether it be household income data, whether that be GNI data that the Scottish government produce. You see that flow of activity, or that dominance of activity of London and South, and then the rest of the UK is less equal as London and South East. So again, one of the criticisms I think of JERS is that you lose that insight into how Scotland compares against other parts of the UK. And again, as we said, I think again what we conclude is that Scotland has relatively higher public spending per head compared to other nations and regions of the UK, with the exception of Northern Ireland and London to an extent. But we also raise a relatively high level of revenue compared to other parts of the UK outside of London and South East. And that's essentially how Scotland is, and that's how Scotland sits. You do the same calculation in places like Wales that you mentioned, you know, even though it might have relatively less public expenditure per head, their revenues are a lot lower. Yeah. So they are notionally in a kind of position where their revenues are less than their expenditure. Same with the North East, same with the North West, etc. So one of the challenges with JERS, and it'll be really interesting to see whether the government start to change this in time, but start to put it in the context of not just Scotland versus the UK, but Scotland relative to other nations of the UK and other and English regions.
It will be interesting. I mean, I think to some extent, the Scottish government suffers here from being kind of trailblazers in some of these figures. They're the first ones to try and produce these figures for a part of the UK. And therefore, the only obvious comparator is the UK as a whole. And that has happened with things like GNI and other sort of innovations that they've had, that, you know, you don't have other figures to necessarily compare them to. And actually, before the ONS did it, JERS was one of the first publications to try and estimate these figures for all the NUTS 1 regions. So that's the three devolved nations and the nine regions of England, to try and have a more realistic comparator than the UK as a whole. And that kind of kicked off the work in a way with ONS to try and do this on a more official basis for the whole of the UK. So to some extent, when you're innovating and producing these new products, that's what happens. But I agree, it's a much more sensible comparator to see this across the UK in these different regions, because London and the South East are such outliers and drag up the UK average so much that it isn't really a fair comparison.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I guess when we're talking about controversies, we can't avoid talking about how this is interpreted and what all this means for the constitution debate. And I think So what I would always start with is just the point you emphasise right at the start, which is JRS is backward looking. It takes the current constitutional settlement as given, all the constraints and benefits that brings, and it's an assessment of, in the particular year in question, how much revenue is estimated to be raised in Scotland and how much expenditure takes place for the benefit of Scotland. And that's what it does. It doesn't claim to do any more or any less. If you then want to start to talk about questions around independence, then you then have to start to think about, well, how would things change? And I think that the Scottish Government had hinted that, though I've not heard any updates on that yet, but the government hinted they might be doing some form of alternative fiscal scenario planning for what independence might look like. And the plan that was announced, I think, in the start of the year or tail end of last year, there might be some variation on JRS this year. Now, I guess, not heard anything because the pandemic probably is dominating most of work that's going on, but it will be interesting to see whether anything does come from that. Because I guess the big thing is, what does JRS say about independence?
Yeah, because as you say, it is backward looking, current constitutional settlement. So it doesn't tell us, if the purpose is to make different choices, build a different sort of economy or a different country, then JRS does not help you with that. But what it does tell you is where we are now. So if somebody's advocating change, it is sensible to take where we are now and then set out how things could change over, the next, 5 to 10 years in order to get to a particular future that you want to get to. So,
yeah, and that's exactly what Andrew Wilson's Growth Commission did, where, again, it's about JRS tells you now where you are now, and you can make some different assumptions and you'll get slightly different numbers. But then you need to start saying, well, where would you spend less? Where would you spend more? Where would you tax differently? And then how would your economy grow? And Andrew Wilson's work did that. You may agree or disagree with some of the assumptions in there and then how it's interpreted, but the basic principle has got to be undoubtedly correct. And I guess that for me, the big thing that comes out from all of that is that JRS tells us that Scotland would face fiscal challenges. The UK faces fiscal challenges. We've got COVID-19, which is going to have a significant impact on the public finances of most countries around the world. We've got an aging population with a shrinking tax base in that context and growing demand in public services. So it's going to be a challenge not just for Scotland, but it's a challenge for the UK. What JRS does do, if you take the assumption methodology in the report, it does suggest that at the start, that challenge is going to be more significant. It's not to say that you can't do anything about it. It's just going to say that challenge is there. And those advocating greater autonomy or reform to different fiscal systems need to basically have a clear plan for how you're going to tackle that and navigate through it.
Yeah, absolutely. And on all this, whenever there's discussion about JRS, it always amuses me sometimes, what JRS is described as describing, So it doesn't describe the Scottish economy as a whole. It is just the public finances. It doesn't tell us about the assets and liabilities of a nation or about, a private sector national income, how much is earned by companies and how much stays in the country. All of these are elements of a successful economy as well. The JRS is the public sector accounts, but it doesn't describe the economy as a whole. It's just that element of, of the public finances. So it's always important to remember that as well. There's lots of other things that will, impact on how successful an economy could be if we were under a different constitutional settlement.
Yeah, and actually the other side of the coin from that is that that actually some really interesting things in JRS that just never get discussed because it gets dominated by a debate around the fiscal position of an independent Scotland and arguments about whether or not it shows the benefits of the union, because Scotland is, in some people's words, being subsidised and benefiting from that. In other people's eyes, it shows actually, you know, Scotland made a significant contribution in the past through oil revenues, and actually the deficit now, or the notional estimated deficit now, is a reflection of Scotland within the Union, and therefore if you look at other small countries, why can't we be like them, successful? So both sides can interpret the same number for their own purposes. But what they miss, and what a lot of this debate misses, is the really interesting things that GER should be focused of attention, like this is what we spend our money on as a country. This is how much we spend on these different services. This is how much more we spend on education than other aspects of our public services. And do we get the right outcomes from that? You know, are we spending the right amount of money on things like defence as a share of our economy? Is it too high? Higher than many other countries? What could be done if you spent less than that on different aspects of the public sector? How do we tax people? Again, it's really interesting if you look at there just how much tax comes off earners on income tax, on national insurance, and how much little comes off on businesses. Again, so really important questions for as a country about how you tax and the relative balance of tax. And sadly, all these issues get missed in the storm that comes around, you know, one number about whether or not Scotland's in deficit or whether that deficit is bigger or smaller than the UK.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's never been more important to scrutinise what we're spending money on and how effective it is. You know, whether you look at what we're spending on economic development or other aspects in order to support businesses through a crisis like we're going through now. It's never been more important to understand how effectively we're spending the money that we are spending, you know, through the devolved system. So, I mean, these are figures that are readily available, and the statisticians who publish GERS publish a really detailed spending database. So anyone who's interested in seeing all of the detail about where we spend money, it's there, you know, you can look at it in huge amounts of detail to see where all this money is going. There is a bit for all of us to try and understand that a bit better and, you know, think about whether we're spending money in the most effective way we can.
Great. Well, so GERS is out on Wednesday morning, and we'll do our usual summary of the key conclusions, and we'll also try our best to try and see through some of the storm and fog that gets created whenever it's published. And I think, I guess, one key message that we would say to people whenever you see the GERS numbers is that, yes, there's, you can have a technical debate about some of the methodology and some of the issues that go into it, but that's not where the debate should be or it ought to be. The debate really should be about is just looking at the numbers and what do they tell us about as a country, what we spend our money on, how we raise our taxes, and also, yes, use it to inform your decision-making around the constitutional debate. So does this show Scotland benefiting from being part of the UK, or does it show Scotland being held back, or does it help you make a judgment about the opportunities and also risks from different constitutional change? So if we can focus the debate on those sorts of issues rather than debates around phantom numbers being created and rogue estimates and rogue allocations, and I think we'll be in a much better place. So thank you very much, Mary, for the chat today. And as you mentioned, there's a guide for GERS on the website. And if you also go onto our website and search for GERS, you'll see all the various articles we've written over the last 2 or 3 years about the various GERS publications. And hopefully that provides a useful resource for you in interpreting the figures. Thank you very much.